Everybody happy to see that despite the rather hot temperatures, almost everybody still here and interested in physics. We started last time to discuss a big section about symmetries in physics and about group theory. Group theory is a mathematical tool to handle symmetries. And I told you we are focusing on continuous symmetries. There's similar things for discrete symmetries. There's the techniques are a little bit different, but still not too different. So it's probably easy for you to also understand discrete symmetry. So whenever you're interested, I know at least one very good book which you could have a look at or borrow or whatever. But due to time limitation, we needed to make a decision, so we're studying continuous symmetries. And the thing with continuous symmetries in physics is usually Lie groups. Lie groups for us is just another word for continuous group theory in a certain sense. And we are not discussing all the details from a mathematical point of view. My aim is rather to give you the basic idea how it works and how it is useful. So if you want to go deeper, then you probably need to consult more advanced literature. And what we did last time, I don't repeat it today on the board because we are doing a very similar thing. Anyway, as a first step today, we discussed a group of rotations in form of matrices. We considered 3x3 matrices and we studied the corresponding Lie group. And the most important things you should remember is that usually it's sufficient to study infinitesimal group transformations, in our case rotations, and this led us to the concept of generators. A generator is the identity plus an infinitesimal parameter times the generator. So the first order Taylor expansion, which is exact for infinitesimal transformations, this is sufficient because any finite rotation can be combined by many, many, many very small rotations. And the most interesting thing about the generators is their behavior under commutations. So when you compute or calculate all the commutators, then you know how simple or difficult the group is, what the structure of the group is. And this has a very deep meaning in physics, and we'll come to this today a bit and continue also in the next subsections. So commutators and generators and the commutators, which is also called the algebra of the group. This is something we have seen for the first time in the last lecture. And as I said, I don't write it down because we are doing now another example, which is extremely similar. So I think it's good as a repetition. Section 5.2.2, another example, complex rotations in two dimensions. Probably you haven't seen this group so much as in normal, ordinary real rotations in three dimensions. But in fact, in physics, this group appears even more often. It's quite simple to define. These are complex 2x2 matrices with the properties R dagger, R equal 1, and determinant of R equal 1. So for normal rotations, when we have real matrices, the condition is R transpose R equal 1, as you know. And now the only thing we change is that the entries of the matrices may be complex. And then we replace the transpose by the dagger. And yeah, this is all the, so the condition for uniparity or unitary matrices. I think this word you have heard before in your mathematics lectures. And therefore, this group has also a certain name. It's called SU2. Last time we called the rotation matrices SO3, O for orthogonal, U now for unitary, 2 is the dimension of the matrix, and S means special, and special is just a word for this additional condition that the determinant is 1. For ordinary rotations, determinant of 1 means that we exclude reflections, and yeah, in complex space it's a bit more hard to imagine what it means geometrically, but in a certain sense it's a, yeah, I would say, same condition as for real matrices. Okay, so now we proceed exactly in the same way as last time, so you can see this also as a repetition. So R dagger R equal 1 is in components equivalent to R dagger, and then JK R KL. And now I can get rid of the dagger by writing the complex conjugate with exchanged indices. So dagger is complex conjugate and transpose. The transpose I can eliminate when I exchange J and K, and then R, K, L, and this is the identity, which in components is delta J, L. And now these are 4 conditions. This is something which one probably doesn't see immediately until you have quite some training with this. I also needed to think a few minutes yesterday in the evening. Why 4 conditions? Meaning, in the first place, you could think, okay, we have a matrix equation, 2 by 2 matrices. So obviously, 4 entries mean 4 equations or 4 conditions. But this is, of course, too simple, because we have complex objects, and complex have a real part and an imaginary part. So actually, these are naively 8 equations. But there are certain symmetries in the indices, and when you work out these symmetries, you find that some equations are less powerful, or some equations are the same when you exchange indices, and you end up with 4 equations. I don't want to do this in detail. I just give you one obvious example. Consider, I mean, the K is a summation index, so we have 2 open indices, J and L. So just consider for a moment J equal 1 and L equal 1. And then, yeah, what do you have? You have a sum over K, and you have always the same quantity R here and here with the same indices. So in a certain sense, this is a condition about the absolute value of these elements, not about a complex number. And the absolute value, of course, is only 1 condition, because the phase of the whole thing is arbitrary. So this is just one example that the complex equation for index 1 and 1 are not 2 equations for imaginary and for the real part, but only 1 equation. Same argument is, of course, true for 2 and 2. And for 1 and 2, I think it's a little bit different. It's that you get the same equation, same 2 equations for 2, 1, and 1, 2. So this is a small exercise for you to work out that we have 4 conditions. Why this is important, you hopefully remember from last time, we need to count now how many parameters we need to parameterize our group elements. This is why it's important to figure out the number of conditions coming from this equation and from that equation. And one can show that this condition here implies that the absolute value of the determinant is 1. And now think again back to ordinary rotations. Such a condition for ordinary rotations is, in a certain sense, not a condition restricting the number of parameters, because for ordinary real rotations, the determinant is also real, and the absolute value of the determinant equal 1 means that the determinant can either be plus 1 or minus 1. So we discussed last time that this condition for ordinary rotations doesn't reduce the number of parameters, it just eliminates half of the possibilities of all group elements. Now we are in complex space, and in complex space, this is of course a different thing. When we have determinant of R, it can be complex. The absolute value 1 means that we have a full condition because of coupling numbers which have much more possibilities than the real numbers. And the thing I want to say, determinant of R equal 1, the second condition is an additional condition which reduces number of parameters by 1. Okay, so now we can count. We have 8 entries in the matrices minus 5 conditions, 1 plus 4. So we have 3 parameters. And this information is useful because now we need to find, or it's sufficient to find, three linearly independent generators, and when we have them, we have a full description and also parameterization of all our group elements. So now, I mean, for rotations, for example, it's easy to imagine the whole thing, but think about much more complex symmetry groups. For example, look at the internet, maybe you know the archive. They are typically every new paper is uploaded there. And when you go to the series section of the archive, you find really weird groups which have many, many generators where there's no chance to visualize geometrically what it means. They are studying whatever SU10 or some really weird groups where you have no chance unless you're doing such a program like counting maybe conditions and number of entries of your matrices or whatever. And when you have figured out the number of parameters, at least formally, you can work your way towards the generators and the parameterization of the group elements. So this is why we are doing it now, still at simple examples, but when it might get more complicated, it's real essential. Good, so now we are writing down infinitesimal SU2 matrices with, and this is important, linearly independent generators. And here we need to find three of them because we have three parameters. And it's not too difficult to find them. One plus I alpha j, I think I can write it in that way, where j has three values, x, y, or z, and this generator j is nothing else than the well-known Pauli matrix divided by 2, which, yeah, let's write it down, is either 1, 1, I minus I, and 1 minus 1. So maybe you don't see it immediately, but what you can, of course, do, take one of the three possibilities, plug it in here, and now take this concrete form and insert it here in the determinant condition and in the R-Dagger-R condition and just check that it's fulfilled. It's a very simple computation, and you will find for all three possibilities that the two conditions are fulfilled. So we have written down three different infinitesimal SU2 transformations, and to see that the generators are linearly independent, I think this is obvious because four entries can be seen as a 4x4 vector. No linear combination of two of these matrices gives the third one. See it, for example, here, the same positions, they are entries, but they have a different sign, so you cannot express the first by the second vector. Yeah, and since we know we have only three parameters, we also know we are done with three of them, so we don't need to investigate further. Of course, you can now ask, okay, I give you the solution, but if I have a complicated group and conditions, how do I find the solutions? I just want to give you the answer that it's not extremely difficult for infinitesimal transformations with such conditions, because you can, for example, make a very general ansatz with four entries A, B, C, D, plug it in, and infinitesimal means always that these conditions become linear, and solving linear systems is not so difficult. In the worst case, when you have big objects or so, take a computer algebra program like Mathematica or Maple, but this is not comparable to the difficulty of solving a linear equation or something like that. It's a technical step, I guess. When you're in need of it and start doing it, you will succeed working out these techniques by yourself. I think it just wouldn't slow us down and distract from the more complicated and more important thing of group theory. So now we have generators, and the next step, and slowly it's getting interesting, is to calculate the commutators. And yeah, also this is an exercise which I don't present on the board, but I guess you anyway know the answer. The commutators of the Pauli matrices divided by 2, you have seen before. It is just the angular momentum algebra, because we knew these things already from spin and spin transformations. Probably in quantum mechanics one, you have seen it before, and also in the previous section about relativistic quantum mechanics, when we considered spin, we also had a similar thing. And now this is maybe surprising, maybe also not, but at least interesting. As I told you, these commutators, which are also called the algebra, or in this concrete case, the angular momentum algebra. This is the same as for SO3. Of course, SU2 and SO3 are not the same groups, but it seems that they behave very, very similar because they have exactly the same algebra. And it's not in the script, I come later to it, but nevertheless, I tell you now because this is the important thing what we would like to understand and where we would like to go. The fact that different groups can have the same algebra means that in certain sense they describe the same operations. And your source is already in the Dirac equation, for example, or also in the Pauli equation. When you apply a rotation to the spatial coordinate, you do an ordinary real three-dimensional rotation. When you apply a rotation to a spin, since we worked out, you, if you remember, you take the Pauli matrices up as an exponent of an exponential function, and you rotate it basically with what we learned now to be the group SU2. And in physics, when you construct a new theory, you first decide what kind of symmetries need to be fulfilled. Then you write down a corresponding group, for example, the Lorentz group, which we'll do later today, or if you have an internal symmetry, whatever symmetry group you like, you work out the generators, you find the algebra, and then you cannot only, or you're not only allowed to use objects transforming with this particular group, but you can use any group having the same algebra, because the algebra in a certain sense says what the group does. In particular, we had it last time, when we rotate around the x-axis and the y-axis, or we do it in a different way, first the y-axis and the x-axis. This answer is given by the algebra. And for example, both SU2 and SU3 have exactly the same structure. Therefore, when we have an object in our Lagrangian transforming according to SU2 and another object transforming according to SO3, and we do a couple of transformations, in a certain sense at the end, they are still consistent because the overall structure represented by the algebra is the same. And this is the basic, and in a certain sense also the magic of group theory, which allows to really construct complex theories from new symmetry groups and algebras by finding, come later in more detail to set, finding different representations. He seems to have a completely different opinion about symmetries.
I have a question. So if two different groups have the same algebra, does it mean that they satisfy the same symmetry? Or like if you do a symmetry transformation to that particular Lagrangian?
They are not transforming in exactly the same way, but say let me give you a little bit of more detailed answer. This is the algebra. This is the same for two different groups. The groups itself or themselves look different, like SU2 and SO3 matrices. The objects on which these group elements act also look different. Two component complex vectors, three component real vectors. But they have a consistent transformation law. So, for example, you can combine these objects to arrive, for example, at a Lorentz scalar, which you need for the action. Let me give you another example. I just said SO3 is a transformation for space-time vector. Write it down in the following way. What we for example learned in the section about relativistic wave equations was the transformation law of bilinears. We had this object here, and we understood it transforms as an ordinary 3-vector, right? And now we have also the R is a position vector. This very trivially transforms as a 3-vector. So what we could do is, or let me even use the gradient. What we could now do is use this object. This reminds already very closely to the kinetic term of the Dirac equation. This is a Lorentz scalar. Now, coming back to what's on the upper board, this thing here is an ordinary 3-vector. You could put in this list also the normal spatial coordinates. Here's the rotation is SO3, ordinary rotations. Here, it's not 100% correct. We can correct it in a minute, but I hope you understand it a bit better because you're more used to the Dirac spinors. Here and here, the transformation law is that of spins, SU2. It's not 100% consistent with what is up there because you have 4 components and not 2 components. The reason is you studied in your homework once the Weyl representation. Do you remember? The Weyl representation says basically that you have an upper and a lower entry, and one is a so-called right-handed, the other one a left-handed spinor. And to be fully consistent or correct, the upper one and the lower one are both things which transform under SU2. And so the main message, or what I want to say, is a few weeks ago or so, we wrote down the Dirac equation, a bit phenomenological, and because of problems of the Klein-Gordon equation. At the end, we had something which was obviously covariant, and we were happy. Now, in 2 or 3 weeks of time, just as an example to illustrate this much more powerful technique, we can approach the same thing in a completely different way. We say we would like to have the Lorentz symmetries. Part of the Lorentz symmetries are the rotations. So we need to add boosts, but this is not the main point here. Then this is the corresponding algebra, or at least part of the Lorentz algebra. Then we make a list of whatever representations we would like to have. SO3 is a candidate, SU2 is a candidate. There are many, many more. And now we can select concrete representations, which means objects like spinors transforming according to SU2, space-time vectors transforming according to SO3, also more complicated things. We could also write down a spin 5-half object. It has a much more complicated group. And then if we understand better how these things transform, we also know how to construct, for example, Lorentz scalars, which gives an allowed action. And this is a way to go when you want to derive more complicated theories, because when you don't have clear experimental evidence, for example, like it was in QCD, color or so is not measurable, or when you would like to extend the standard model, or for example, also I guess the Higgs particle was introduced before it was measured 40 years before, so people had no measurement or experiment where they could orient their thinking, but the group theory in a certain sense constrained very strongly what you can write down as a Lagrangian. And this is an extreme power of group theory, understanding what kind of mathematical objects you can combine to, for example, Lorentz scalars or to covariant equation of motion or covariant wave equation. And to formalize this is the goal of the whole thing. So now I said something which I didn't want to tell you now in all the detail, but since this is the main message of not only this lesson, also the next week and second next week, I probably repeat it many times. As soon as you have fully understood it, you can leave and come back in 2 weeks for the last section. But I think it's a very complicated thing. When I read it first in a book, it was quantum field theory by Ryder. In a section about the Dirac equation, I didn't understand it. And it took me 2 years as a PhD student until I finally understood how powerful this is and how this works in the general case. So this is the goal, to teach you this thing in the group theory section. Okay, so we are almost done with the second example. The last point is important, but I think not too difficult. Finite SU2 transformations can be written in the following way. R of alpha equal exponential of plus I alpha j and generator. This is not particular to any group. We had the same form for SO3 and we'll always have the same form because this is this relation that 1 plus x over n to the power of n is the exponential of x if you send n to infinity. We had this already a couple of times. So whenever you have infinite transformations, by just combining many of them, you go back to finite ones. And once you have the commutators, you really have a parametrization of all possible SU2 elements. This is also a very powerful thing because if I would have given you the task, write down a parametrization of all SU2 elements without knowing about generators, it probably wouldn't have been so easy. So I guess there was not so much new. It was essentially the same as for SO3, but more important was to realize that the algebra of two different groups can be the same. And what Andre asked is where the whole thing leads to, namely that seemingly different groups can, in a certain sense, represent the same operation in physics, and therefore the corresponding objects can be combined. But we'll come to that later. Now, as an intermediate step, we are discussing the difference of a group versus the algebra. Relations like this one, it's in the script 265. And the same thing for SO3, which was 260. Are called algebra or Lie algebra. Then just an observation, we had it SO3 and SU2 and also others which we haven't seen yet have the same algebra. Yeah, then what I try to tell you already in a lot of words, algebra in a certain sense it gives a basic mathematical structure. And the consequence for the two examples above is that SO3 and SU2 behave similarly. Yeah, then what I've said here, with the others, I give you a third example which fulfills the same algebra like SO3 and SU2, something which you have probably seen even before. Another, this is also a common and important word, representation of the angular momentum algebra is the following, namely the generators J with index J can be defined as the angular, the orbital angular momentum operators, where the orbital angular momentum operator is, as usual, R cross P. So this is an exercise we did early in quantum mechanics one, that the commutators of, for example, Lx and Ly is E times Lz and so on. And this is probably or was probably the first time where you saw this very important and famous algebra. And now this is a good example because this is a completely different type of mathematical objects. Here we had matrices in three or two dimensions, but still two matrices are quite similar. Now we have a different thing. We have operators, and when you think about concrete representations, you have here just R and here I times the gradient. So we have derivative operators, and these things do not act on two or three component vectors, but they act on functions, typically on wave functions. So you see things which are mathematically completely different by the number of components or the amount of information they contain. They can still transform in a very similar way when you find a representation of the same algebra. So let's study this a bit more in detail. As before, exponential of I alpha j gives a finite group element and it acts on either in an abstract way when we keep the dagger here on a bra or a cat, or when using the correspondence principle, namely P replaced by minus I gradient, then it acts on wave functions psi of R. Yeah, then it's a bit of a lengthy point, but an important one. Same algebra for SO3, SU2, and here we don't have a concrete name. I just write for the angular momentum operators. Guarantees consistent and appropriate transformation law with respect to rotations. Yeah, let's briefly study or think about the three examples again. Say, in a certain sense, trivial thing is SO3. There, the statement that it's a consistent transformation law with respect to rotations is obvious because we constructed SO3 from rotation matrices. So there's, of course, nothing deep in it. We wrote down rotations and said, what is the group, what is the algebra? And only in the next step today, we saw that SU2 has the same algebra and also sees things. Yeah, then the next simple thing to understand that it's a consistent transformation law with respect to rotations is what we just discussed, namely the orbital angular momentum operators. So the claim is that this thing here generates a consistent rotation when I apply it to, which I've written down here, on functions or wave functions psi. And maybe you've seen such things before, but probably in a less formal way, maybe not. Let's understand why this thing gives an appropriate transformation law. So the statement I'm going to prove is the following. The rotation of a wave function can be written as R alpha. R alpha is the rotation operation which I apply to psi of R. And if what I claim is correct, we just take this representation here and let it act on the wave function. So exponential of I alpha j L j on psi of R. And this must be, I mean, we know how the rotation on a wave function or on any function looks like. When we have a function, and here I don't mean a Dirac spin, or it's just a one-component wave function from ordinary quantum mechanics. When we do such a rotation of a function with a spatial argument, we just have to rotate the spatial argument. So the result, when we do the mathematics, must be this one, where now we have a 3x3 rotation matrix. So the question is this true? And if yes, can you show it? And the question is, yeah, it is true, and you can show this. And I'm not going to do the full proof, but at least part of the proof. I consider rotations around the z-axis and show you that at least for those rotations, this is correct. And the rest is, yeah, conceptually identical. And if you like, you can do it as a homework. Let me maybe just make it more precise. What I mean here with Lj, when I speak about a wave function, is, of course, L after the correspondence principle. So epsilon j k l r k, and then minus I dl. So nothing else than the quantum mechanical angular momentum operator. So now the proof only for rotation around z-axis, and this proof, I mean this proof here. So around the z-axis we have only non-vanishing angle. This third component here, we apply this thing to a function r. As before, it's the exponential of I alpha, then just the z component, psi of r. And yeah, now in the next step, e to the I alpha minus I d phi psi of r theta phi. So what did I do? I just write the argument as spherical coordinates r theta and phi. Not sure whether you are familiar with this. Think maybe back about quantum mechanics one, when you wrote down also angular momentum operators in terms of cylindrical or spherical coordinates, you found that the z component has a very simple representation. It reminds you strongly on not an angular momentum, a normal momentum operator, minus I and the derivative. This time, the derivative of the angle, or with respect to the angle phi. If you don't remember this, then naja, just take this definition, which you have here, and replace the derivatives with appropriate derivatives with respect to spherical or cylindrical coordinates, and then you find it. So this is not the main point of this proof was an essential thing. This is indeed from quantum mechanics one. What's now proving the whole thing here, and what is more interesting, is the next step. We had it, I think, a couple of times before. When you have a function of a derivative or a function of a matrix, the only way to define this is to write down the Taylor series. And the Taylor series of an exponential function is very well known. It's an infinite sum over j, then the argument alpha to the power of j divided by the factorial of j, and in the exponent we also have a derivative which acts then on psi. So we have dj psi over d, now there's a typo on the script, d phi j, and formally we can put the arguments here. Okay, and now what is this, what we have written down here? This is nothing else than the Taylor expansion of psi with respect to Entwicklungspunkt expansion point phi equals zero and with argument alpha. Probably it's a bit more convenient for you if I would have written the alpha at the end of this. An ordinary Taylor expansion has coefficients, zero, first, second, third, derivative, and so on, multiplied with 1 over factorial of the summation index. And this is a typically small parameter. If you stop the series after a certain number of terms, but when you go to infinity, it holds basically for any alpha. So therefore, what we have is psi of r theta phi plus alpha. And this basically proves exactly the statement I wanted to prove, because in the last coordinate rotation around the z axis, a rotation is very simple in these arguments, namely it's just phi plus the angle we are rotating. You can imagine why I chose the z component, because here it's much more easy to formulate it, but I think it's straightforward to also work it out for x and the y component. So I hope this is sufficient that you believe this statement, that indeed applying the rotation in this rather abstract way, namely just exponentiating the operator representation, gives you what I said here, an consistent and appropriate transformation law with respect to rotations. And once you believe that it always works, and indeed you can make more and more examples, and at some point I guess I hope you start to believe it, you can of course also go the next step, namely the last in our current example, go to SU2. For SU2, we have probably no geometrical intuition how it looks or what it does. But formally, we can write down the same thing, namely take the SU2 generator, exponentiate it, let it act on two component complex vectors, and the thing you always find at the end is that this gives a consistent transformation law with respect to rotations. So also groups which at first glance have nothing to do with rotations, once they fulfill the corresponding algebra, which is the angular momentum algebra, these objects can be used in series to define consistent series, because they have, like this one here, very structured and consistent transformation law. Yeah, the last statement. As I said, you cannot make very explicit mathematics here. As you do matrices, I just refer to a previous section, describe rotations of two component complex spinors e.g. in the Pauli equation. Good. Next point is a summary. We had it already before. I guess I repeat it after the break, then maybe you have 5 minutes time to think about it or also formulate questions. It's really the most abstract and most difficult thing from a conceptual point of view, in my opinion. So please ask and let us discuss until you have understood it. But yeah, let's do this at 11:19. Okay, before we continue with physics, two things which I briefly wanted to show you or discuss with you. First are the results from the evaluations. So first of all, thank you very much. The vast majority of evaluation results was very, very good. So I'm happy that you seem to be happy. I think there are many numbers which, in my opinion, are anyway not so interesting. I guess the most important number is the Schulnote, which is a third line from above, which is between 1 and 2, and Besuch lohnt sich between 5 and 6. So 5 and 6 is good, and 1 and 2 is good in this thing. So as I said, I was very happy when I saw it. So thank you very much. More interesting are probably the written comments, and let's briefly scroll down. The amount of work you invest, I think it seems like reasonable, between something 4 to 8 hours is a good thing for a theory lecture. I think the positive statements you made, we don't need to discuss a lot because it's anyway quite good. So let's go down to maybe say points of criticism, bitte nennen Sie Verbesserungsmöglichkeiten. I think you also understand, those of you who speak English, because I guess you have evaluated it. Die Sinnhaftigkeit mancher Aufgaben ist nicht immer nachvollziehbar. This is of course not my intention to give you just senseless things to do, only Arbeitsbeschaffungsmaßnahmen. Not 100% sure whether this is a general opinion or only the opinion of one person. So in case there's something where you have to work a lot but don't understand why you are doing it, please tell me or write me an email. Of course, some of the tasks in this semester were also to practice skills calculating things. I mean, when you have to transform gamma matrices or do a proof from the lecture, so of course you don't learn a lot of new physics, but as in sports or so, you need to train also the physicists. If you don't transform equations many hours a day, you will never become somebody being good at calculations. So maybe it refers to some of these exercises, because some others, I guess, had clear physical goals or statements associated with it. But yeah, again, if there's any such thing where you don't understand why you should do it, please let us discuss or ask me what is the intention of this tutorial. Yeah, since the next point seems somebody wants to have less details on the board, but there's also another one here which suggests somebody wants more mathematical details on the board. So in a certain sense, yeah, these statements cancel, I would say, each other. I mean, it's always a compromise, of course. When I do all the steps, we do less new things, and it becomes a bit boring. When I shift everything to the exercises, I always say, you can show it, but I won't. At some point, you start to not believe me anymore. It's not 100% clear what I should do in the future. My suggestion is, those of you who are unhappy when I say you can prove this and you are getting really annoyed by this, tell me no, I want to see it now, then I can also show it on the board, or vice versa, when I repeat the fifth example or so and you're really bored by now, say, okay, we got it, we believe it, just go on with physics. Tell me in the lecture, I'm happy for any feedback I'm getting. Script früher hochladen. In general, I would agree. I'm doing it usually the evening before the lecture because this is when I prepare the lecture. But in this particular case, I guess you have noticed 2 years ago, I gave the same lecture and the script is 100% identical. So if you really want to work in advance or so, just go back, whatever, don't know, 5 screens or so until you reach quantum mechanics from summer semester 2017. The only difference is when I insert the dates or so, but when you have been in the lecture, you anyway know where you are. So don't worry, I most likely won't change anything for the rest of the semester. Then am besten auf Deutsch, nicht auf Englisch halten. Yes, I agree. I prefer to speak in German. My English, as you know meanwhile, is not excellent, in particular not accent-free. By the way, my old English teacher in high school once got really mad on me. He said my English pronunciation is worse than the, I tell it in German, er hat gesagt, ich spreche mein Englisch deutscher aus wie die alten Nazis. So maybe he was right in a certain sense. I know it's not excellent. When I hear sometimes my own videos, I think, could be better, but it is as it is. And as long as we have the opportunity to study in English, the master, of course, I need to give it in English. I have no choice, and it would be unfair to Andre and to, sorry, don't know your first name, to speak now on German. So we need to do it in English. We have no other option here. English is script. Not sure whether it came from one of you. So I immediately understand it, that you want to have the notes in English. The reason, and here I have to apologize, is just that it's a lot of work to do a script and to translate a script for probably only one remaining semester, because I guess you have heard the department is in the process of canceling the English master program. So in 2 years or so, probably it will always be in German. Yeah, I wanted to avoid it. So I admit it would be better to have an English script, but as I said, for one last year to translate it, I wanted to save it. Exercises, Übungen mehr auf Inhalte abstimmen, do the exercises closer to the lecture, so I mean, of course, we are 3 weeks usually behind the lecture, but it's natural because you have to submit it, the guys have to correct it, and then you have to discuss it. But otherwise, I would have said we are usually doing things which are tied to the lecture. Again, if you feel otherwise or so, please tell me in person or by an email, or we can also discuss it anytime in the lecture, when or why you are unhappy with the exercises. Yeah, then mehr Vielteilchen-Theorie, more multi-particle theory. I can say yes, this is a valid point. I do very little multi-particle theory. I reserved only 3 lectures at the end, and probably other people, perhaps they are doing, don't know, 10 lectures or so on multi-particle theory. Of course, we are limited in time and we need to make decisions. The main reason why I don't do too much multi-particle theory is because the whole quantum field theory 1 and 2 is basically a multi-particle theory lecture. So the multi-particle physics in quantum mechanics is a step towards quantum field theory, but not the full thing. I'm not saying it's useless. I think in particular in the first floor in the solid state groups, this is used quite commonly, but I think the same concepts you can learn in quantum field theory. And my impression is also that many people in their career students are visiting quantum field theory and quantum mechanics too at some point. So if there's a strong overlap, it's getting a bit boring. Therefore, my decision to focus more on group theory and on scattering theory, which is certainly pretty much decorrelated from the quantum field theory thing. This is the reason, but still I understand the point, in particular when perhaps somebody is working in solid state physics and not planning to attend quantum field theory and hope that he or she would learn a lot here, then this selection of topics is not ideal. Zusätzliche Möglichkeit, Fragen zu stellen. Usually, in particular those who heard theory 1 to 3 with me, there I always established an additional hour where you could come. I had nothing to do with new topics, or you didn't need to attend, but where you could go and ask me things, a Fragestunde. I didn't even ask this semester because my experience in the more advanced lectures, there was zero interest from the students until now. So if I would have known earlier, we could have done or set up an additional time slot where we could just discuss problems. I think now it's a bit late. I'm also not sure whether this is something only one person would prefer, or whether this is more people who would like it. Doing it before or after the lecture is maybe not such a good idea, because immediately after us there's another lecture starting, and since there are only 3 or 3.5 weeks left, my suggestion is not to establish any new thing now, but please come to my office or ask me, or ask me in the break or so. I'm in fact very happy to discuss with you, because this gives me a bit more feedback what you understood and what you not understood. So particular in a special lecture with not too many students, but all of them typically very interested, it's a lot of fun to discuss. Come to me, also come to me when you prepare for the oral exams. I'm happy to help, and we can discuss as long as you are interested. Zusätzliche mehr Hinweise für die Übungen. I'm happy to give help for the tutorials. I'm happy if you are trying the tutorials, or any help I can give you. I'm happy to give also the tutors. It's of course a bit difficult in advance to understand where the problems in the tutorials are. Sometimes Christian Reisinger, who organizes the tutorials, puts a hint on the sheet. My suggestion is if you encounter problems when doing the exercises, visit either me or visit the tutor, and I'm also happy to explain in advance to you the solution. I mean, of course, I cannot hand out the solution to anybody, but when you have tried it and say, here, I don't understand what the next step is, the point is that you are successfully doing the exercise, and if a tip helps or so you get it anytime. Also here, email is not so good because tips are usually complicated, but try to find me in the office or ask me on Tuesday, or as I said, go to your tutor. Ja, Punkteverteilung unverhältnismäßig, okay, it's a bit hard to say. I think we try to assign points depending on how long the solution is, but of course there might be quicker and less quick solutions. Aufgaben sind verwirrend gestellt und das Ziel der Aufgaben unklar. Also here I understand you could make it probably more precise in a written exam. I would say make the assignment simpler but more precise, but on an exercise sheet, on a weekly exercise sheet, I'm not sure whether to be too precise is really the way to go forward. I mean, in research, sometimes you need to understand, first of all, what is an interesting question. So if the question on the exercise sheet is not 100% clear, maybe you should consider this even part of your exercise. And when you do something which was not intended by us, I would say it's not a bad thing which happened. It's as useful as doing anything else, which is related to the topic we are discussing at the moment. Of course, again, here you can ask me anytime or the tutors. When it's not clear what to do, then we tell you what was our intention. Ja, Übungen sollten ausführlicher besprochen werden. I guess it's the problem of time limitation. Probably the tutors do 90 minutes or so. Or do they send you away early? Not? Okay. Then I should speak with them. And is this in all tutorials or only in a very particular one? So who is too quick? Niklas is too quick. Okay, I can speak with him or ask him that he does it a bit slower and in more detail. Good. And now I missed it somewhere, but it was part of this evaluation. Somebody said, please load up the videos earlier. This is common, not to me, but Kollege vom Filmteam, einer der Kommentare war, die Videos eher ins Netz zu stellen. Ist es irgendwie möglich? Oder? Okay. Gut. Okay. Gut, also ja, ich denke es, auch wenn es jetzt Kritikpunkte waren, it was not very harsh critics, it was very useful critics, but yeah, since we are already quite late in the semester, it's hard to improve it. I try my best, but in particular concerning the exercises, ask me immediately or tell me if you are unhappy with something on whatever Tuesday or already via an email in advance, then maybe we can correct it or give hints or any explanation during the week when you're going to do it. Any more comments from your side to the evaluation or suggestion or criticism or so? Then, yeah, thank you very much again, particular also for the positive comments, which were very nice to hear. Then another thing which might be interesting for you, and now I have a problem because I cannot read this. This thing here. It's more an announcement together with a together with a colleague, René Meyer, he's from the University of Würzburg. We are organizing a very short 2-day school for bachelor and master students, which might be of interest for you. On the PhD level, there are many such schools, and typically when you're doing your PhD, you're going there every year. So for students, it's less common. So we did it already 2 years ago. Not sure where you. No, you didn't attend. But at least 2 years ago, we did a very similar thing. And yeah, the idea is to meet in a place not very far away. It's close to Darmstadt, a cloister, a monastery. And we have two speakers, two professors, which are giving, in a certain sense, lectures on advanced topics in theoretical physics, but on a level where you should be able to follow. And but the main intention is probably not to just go there to hear additional lectures. It's more to go there to discuss in a nice and friendly and relaxed atmosphere, to meet new friends. It's not only for Frankfurt students, but also for Würzburg and Jena students, and basically for any student can register, but there we advertise it. And yeah, so if you have time on 2nd and 3rd October, and when you are interested, here you see the conditions. You should have fun with theoretical physics. You should know a bit of quantum mechanics, which you certainly do. And if you like to discuss, then this might be the ideal thing for you. You'll find more information on my webpage. So you know, I guess, this thing here. And there's a link on advanced quantum mechanics. And when you scroll down a little bit, you find this page here, which contains the poster I've just shown you, a bit more details, for example, what and where this monastery is. The two speakers, one is from Würzburg, the other one from Jena. Basically, it doesn't cost much. It's 10 euro per person, so basically food. And also the night in the cloister is for free. Also traveling costs, but I guess for the Frankfurt people, going to something close to Darmstadt is anyway free due to the semester ticket. In case you're staying or living at home during the semester and need to come via train, then write it in your registration email. We probably can also cover this. And yeah, it would be good if you could decide until 4th of August, because of the room situation. We need to book rooms in the cloister. And yeah, when you register, send an email, please, not only to me, but also to the other guy in Würzburg. The reason is we are limited, of course, by the facilities there. So around 30 or 35 people is the maximum we can cover. And if more people or more students are interested, we, of course, need to decide. And then it's good if I and he has all the registrations and not I have 30% and he has whatever, 70%, and a couple of them were sent to both things. So please, per default, use both email addresses. And also write not a lot of text, maybe 2 or 3 lines, who you are, what your university is, what your semester is, and also 2 sentences why you would like to participate. This is, in particular, the last thing is for the case when we need to make decisions when there are more interested people, then we have room in the monasteries, and we need to decide. And it's not based on Marx or on whatever, but like this. But we need to know a little bit who you are and why you would like to attend. And the program is like that. So basically, we have lectures. We start with a lunch on the first day and have lectures in the afternoon. And on the second day, it goes through the full day. But it's very informal. So there are a lot of coffee breaks, a lot of room for discussion. I don't know, maybe even exercises or so, depends on the speakers. Yeah. So if you are interested, I would be happy if you come along. Also tell it to your friends. And yeah, if you have more questions, just approach me. By the way, cloister sounds like they have good wine or good beer. Last time I said the same when I advertised it, and I was extremely disappointed. There was a wine cellar, and I got the key from the big boss of the cloister, and I went to bed rather early, and I gave the key to the wine cellar to one of the students. The next morning I wanted to count how many bottles were missing, and I think there were 30 participants also, and I think they managed to drink 3 bottles of wine, not per person, in total. So hopefully you can do better. Good. Okay. That was about... Yeah, we are anyway now almost done, only 5 minutes left. So perhaps I repeat in words what is written in the script. We had it today, but since it's important, I say it again. So the central idea of this group theory and symmetry thing in physics is the following. The construction of useful and consistent physical theories or equations requires building blocks. And building blocks in our case are the objects on which the group elements act. For example, 2-component complex vectors for SU2, or 3-component real vectors for SO3, or wave functions or fields when you have the orbital angular momentum operator. And these building blocks need to transform in a consistent way. And the consistent way means that the group elements, their generators, fulfill the same algebra. And now for physics, the important transformations are those which represent the symmetries of the theory. So most prominently, Lorentz transformations. Any relativistic theory needs to have Lorentz symmetry. So next time on Thursday, we work out the Lorentz group, all the generators. And for example, to write down a new consistent relativistic field theory, we need to find representations of the Lorentz groups, just as we did today for ordinary rotation in a simpler thing. And then we know the building blocks, and we can, in a formal way, combine the building blocks to relativistic equations which transform covariantly, or relativistic actions which don't transform or are invariant on the Lorentz transformations. But Lorentz transformations are not the whole thing. For example, you can also extend the Lorentz or Poincaré group. A typical example is supersymmetry. You might have heard the word supersymmetry before. It's an additional speculated symmetry between fermions and bosons. I think writing it down like people did in a historic way it would be very difficult for supersymmetry, but extending the Lorentz algebra by other commutators is straightforward, and then finding and constructing the corresponding series is straightforward, but it's tedious. When you take a book from supersymmetry, the Lagrangian might take 2 full pages in a book. So no chance to get it by just playing around, but with this, in a certain sense, weapon, when you understand the symmetry things, you can construct it without much difficulties. You just need to be careful that you don't miss any term. And maybe more important, if we are not going beyond the standard model, are internal symmetries. Think about QCD. The color symmetry is also a very, very important symmetry, and the corresponding group is called SU3, basically what we did today, but complex 3x3 matrices, or flavor symmetry. It's only approximate, but you might know the up and down quarks are almost massless. There's a symmetry called isospin symmetry, which, for example, implies that proton and neutron have approximately the same mass. All these things are very, very useful to construct or understand also the structure of these Lagrangian. And I mentioned before, some time ago, that the 4 fundamental forces in nature, or basically the whole standard model Lagrangian, is nothing else than writing down the Lorentz group and the simplest internal symmetry groups which you can have, and then also combining a selection of the most simple objects, so you don't have much degrees of freedom. I would say just doing the mathematics, when you wouldn't know anything about physics or our world, but know these group theory things, and I guess you would have something very, very similar to our standard model. So understanding these group things, not what was now on the board, it's not sufficient, but maybe it's the end of the lecture when you go even further, really allows you to understand fundamental physics. Yeah, was again a lot of words, but I hope you get the message that symmetries are the most important thing for physics, in particular particle physics, but I guess also any other discipline of physics, symmetries are needed. I suggest we stop here, and next time we continue with the Lorentz and Poincaré group.